Philosophers.
Philosophers.
So, does context matter, David?
It depends on the context.
Well, there you go. That's our topic for today. And my awful segue into it.
So, we originally entitled this episode, Does Context Matter? But that, just by the naming it that, it's kind of an acknowledgement to leading the question, I guess, a little bit, because we wrote that topic down, what, how long ago?
Oh, over a year, probably.
Over a year ago now, yeah. And when we came across it today, we were considering it as a topic under a different context than what it was probably written.
Yes.
So we're going to talk about it. David, why don't you start us off with what you were thinking when we asked that question, and then we'll kind of go into that.
So the way the conversation ended up here is we started talking about how certain people will redefine words to suit an argument they're trying to make. It's sort of a form of begging the question. And the example that came to mind was how particular fields in universities will redefine a word like racism and qualify it by saying that one cannot be truly a racist unless they also have the power to act upon their hatred. But in all, you know, literary uses of the word prior, it hasn't had that meaning. It's just meant prejudice against somebody for the color of their skin, or the belief in the superiority of one or more races.
Right. And I think it's fair to say that this is not a new practice. Words have often had different meanings academically than they do in the commonplace. I mean, look at any hard science field. They mean different things. I'm just going to pull one out of my, you know, out of my head here. Resistance. You know, when I was in school doing electrical engineering, you know, when we were talking about resistance in that case, we're talking about a very specific definition of what that means. Whereas if if I just say it casually, like, hey, right, what's, you know, are you facing
The one that more people are familiar with, and we have said more times on this show, theory, you know, when the, of course, casual definition of theory is just an idea that somebody has about, you know, a conclusion somebody has about something. Whereas in science, it's a highly qualified term of something that has been tested mostly, if not very rigorously.
Exactly.
And people have, you know, good reason to believe. And the thing that they would say that most people mean when they say theory is hypothesis. We have highly technical language we use to say, to communicate very clearly.
Right.
And so, yeah, so in that sense, I don't have a problem with qualified definitions of words, like a highly qualified definition of racism. The issue that I have with that is when it gets brought into some other argument that is not being highly technical, or if somebody uses that word in one context and someone says, oh, well, that's not true because technical definition.
Right. Just to use the example you gave, that's actually a lot better example than what I had. I remember growing up, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, one of the big debates going on at the time was whether or not to teach evolution in schools. And that's been going on for a long time. But one of the arguments often given then was that it's just a theory, you know, we shouldn't be teaching kids theories as facts. And that's a good example of how those two definitions, the common understanding, was clashing with the scientific definition. Right. And then, you know, today, it's a very similar thing. You have a cultural level of discussion amongst the broader populace about a specific topic, and the definitions that are getting used differ from person to person, both even though they're technically arguing within the same space, you know. But no, I totally agree. So in this case, the context definitely, obviously, does matter. What's also interesting, I think, though, is how those definitions arise. So do you think it matters, you know, which definition precedes the other, or like, how does, you know, does that matter? Like, for example, with theory, I would say that the word theory existed before the scientifically defined, you know, well, rigorously defined term theory. As did the term racist or racism, you know. Does it necessarily matter, I guess, or what? I'm trying to figure out, you know, how do you go about not mixing those two things up? You know, like, how do you keep those definitions in where they belong when you're having a cross-discipline discussion about something?
I think the big thing is this too depends on the context, because if you want to say something that is very technical, and you would have to be long-winded to say it using... I should back up a second. I think normally you should use common definitions of words. You know, take what's in the dictionary. If somebody says a word and you're not certain of the context, assume that they meant the common dictionary definition. And you should use words according to their dictionary definition, when speaking to people. If you want to make an argument that would have to be very long-winded in common language, then establish technical terms. You know, state your definitions. Here's what this word means. I'm going to use this word this way. Now here's my case. And then, you know, just don't be rude and disingenuous when somebody else uses a word by saying, ah, but that word has this technical definition, so your thing doesn't follow. It's kind of hard to draw the line between correcting a misunderstanding and playing word games. So for instance, with your evolution is just a theory example, you know, if someone says, oh, well, evolution is just a theory, and I say, aha, but theory has a technical definition, and that's why your conception about it is inaccurate. You know, one might accuse me of being a hypocrite by pulling up technical language when someone is using a common definition. The difference there is that in that particular situation, I would be enlightening somebody that they are misconstruing technical language somebody else used.
Yeah, I think that's really what it boils down to, is motive. Like, because taking the two examples of the word racism and the word theory, when you look at how they were being used, I think it's important to note who is making the original argument, like, or what's being addressed. So, for example, the theory of evolution was not named the theory of evolution to be misleading. It wasn't named that to try to, like, it was named that because that is the accurate technical name, right? And so when another person looks at it and says, well, it's just a theory, if you don't assume malice, you know, they may just be ill-informed. And if your intention is just to inform, that's fine. But because you don't necessarily... you don't necessarily change your argument by changing the definition. What you're doing is you're trying to address why an argument being made to you isn't an argument. It's a misunderstanding. Whereas I think, and that's kind of why, because I had to have a, you know, I'm having to reconcile these two things, because I myself had a pet peeve with people using the technical definition for racism in just an everyday discussion as a way to essentially try to win an argument. Like, it's hard not to let my confirmation bias get in the way, because I, you know, I have my opinions about certain topics in which that term comes up, and when I'm addressed and I say, I think that act may or may not have been racist, when I'm confronted with the term, I have to consider the motive of the person telling me that term, you know, like, they're telling me that definition. And I would say that there's been times where I feel like that term's definition either was changed or is being changed to suit an agenda, whereas when it comes to like the use of the word theory, when in the context of teaching children the theory of evolution, it didn't change, they didn't change the name theory. I think a more apples to apples comparison would be if they changed the word theory to evolutionary fact. You know what I mean? Like that would have been more misleading, you know. Do you see what I'm trying to say here? Like I'm trying to reconcile
being on seemingly on one side of the issue when it comes to something I'm supportive of, and then being on the other side of it when it's something I don't really agree with.
Right.
You know, because
I think it's normally when we're correcting people about the usage of the word theory in this way, it's a genuine attempt to clear up confusion about what somebody may have heard or read. You know, because obviously if you hear something called the theory of evolution and you think this means the hypothesis of evolution, it's like, okay, well, your guess is as good as mine. Why should I believe you? Not realizing that it became qualified as a theory by having evidence to support it. Right. Meanwhile, right, when you're telling people, well, you can't use the word racist to describe this person because so-and-so, generally that is coming across as a means by which a word is being appropriated as a special insult to call a certain class of person, instead of being a useful and descriptive word, an adjective that can be used to describe anything.
Right. Well, and I think it's at this point we also need to acknowledge not necessarily a synonym, but in practical use, a synonym for context, and that's framing.
Yep.
In the same way that I would say context matters, I would say framing matters as well. Now, for those of you who may not know, framing is not necessarily a journalistic term, but it's used when we discuss journalism a lot. And there's a really good image that describes this perfectly. And it's, you see a composite, you know, the whole image, there is a soldier who has a rifle who is grabbing a man who is in suffering. And another soldier on the other side of him is handing him a bottle of water to like
force feed him some water because he's, you know, in distress, right? Like he's trying to help him. Depending on how you cut that image and crop it, you can either show one soldier giving him a bottle of water or one soldier appearing to like manhandle the guy, or you can just cut it down to just the guy in suffering. You can tell a different story or have a different narrative, but it's all the same picture. The reality of the situation is encompassed by the picture, which even then it's not totally, because you don't know where this is happening or what else is happening around outside the frame.
You're still stuck in a frame. Yes.
You're still stuck in a frame, but it's a more complete frame than any of these subsequent frames. So a good example of this would be someone seeing that picture and saying, I have a vested interest in telling a story about military aggression and crimes. So I'm going to crop out the part where one of the guys is helping him, because now the image supports more along the narrative that I'm talking about. You could also say, well, I'm writing a story about how, you know, about these soldiers who are saving lives in this area. And so I'm going to crop the guy who, it might be distress, but it could be misconstrued as aggression towards this other man. I'm going to crop that part out and just show the gentleman giving him a bottle of water, you know. And so the same thing can be done without images, you know, obviously the same thing can be done with words. And a lot of the term fake news being used these days has to do not with anything in particular being strictly factually incorrect. It has to do more with how things are being framed, you know. And I think that goes back as well as, are you changing definitions to change framing? You know, I think that's another thing that needs to be considered. You're changing the context of what something means in order to try to achieve an agenda. And that's the thing, is framing almost always, if not always, is done to change a perspective.
a good example of this is I took a course in college.
It wasn't offered by the university. It was done by a private institution. Just a little brief background. I was a member of a student organization, and I eventually ended up serving on their executive board, and then eventually got elected to being the president of that organization. It was a very large organization. You know, we had a five-figure budget, you know, paid for by the university and everything to do stuff. Well, one of the things that I did was I took all of my executive members who were meant to lead other people, and we went and did like this two-week course on how to essentially deal with people, you know, be better communicators and be better leaders. And one of the things covered there talked about framing, and it was that you can't change a person's mind, and you can't, like, you can't make somebody do anything. You can't make someone change their mind. But what you can do in a conversation, you can't put words in someone else's mouth, but what you can do is change framing. And by changing framing, you can help change how people think about something. And you can use this advantageously, especially when leading people. If you have to motivate somebody, you can frame something in a certain way that is still true, but framing it this way will be more incentivizing to the person, whereas framing another way might be disincentivizing, you know. And another term for this actually is doublespeak. You know, that's a real term for what we're talking about is, you know, I'm going to tell you some bad news, but I'm going to tell it to you in a way that you're not going to have a emotional initial reaction. Instead, you might react more rationally, but it's the same news. You know, doctors do this all the time. You know, the surgeon walks out in the middle of surgery to the family and says, well, we've run into a couple of complications. Things will be fine. But we've had to, and then drop some technical terminology that they won't fully understand. You know, that's the people will be more likely to take it with, okay, this is something serious, but it seems like they're under control. Whereas he could also come out and say, well, I accidentally sewed up a scalpel inside your dad, so I'm going to have to go back in there and dig it out. Like, that sounds terrible, you know, but if he says it, you know, oh, we've had some obstructions we need to go back in and remove. Okay, that sounds, they're both true, but one sounds a lot less worse than the other to your ears, just on the initial impact, you know. So what are your thoughts on framing and doublespeak? Like, is it advantageous? I mean, is it unavoidable that we can use those things, or like, what are your thoughts on?
I mean, it's unavoidable that we can use those things. I dislike using them. I'm a very straightforward kind of person, and there are other places in the medical profession in which straightforwardness is very valued. For instance, medical professionals do not use euphemisms for death. If you're in the waiting room and your loved one dies in the operating room, somebody will come out and tell you this person has died. They won't say they passed away. They won't say they've moved on. They'll say they died. And that's how I like to be with these kind of things. Like, just tell it to me straight. I'm going to tell it to you straight so that we can make decisions and move on.
What do you think there is a mutual benefit to perhaps, you know, to double speak? Like, is there ever a time in which it might be mutually beneficial to both the person communicating the information and the other person receiving the information? Like, to give you an example, say I was that doctor and I made a mistake and I need to go back and fix it, but I also need to address the family because they have a concern. If I told you that I needed to tell them and I asked your advice on how to tell them, besides being straight, like, do you think that there is a way I could engage in doublespeak that would be better than me just dropping the straight facts to those people? Or is it not up to me to make that call? Like, what, you know?
I know a lot's open to personal preference, but I just kind of want to know what your thoughts are on it.
I don't know. I think maybe it might depend on whether the person you're informing actually has the power to do anything about the situation. Like, if you're a surgeon and you left a scalpel blade inside of somebody by mistake, well, they're not going to go in there and get it. You are. So all they really need to know is there's been a complication and we need to go resolve the issue.
But you see what I'm saying? Like, I think as long as we're not attributing motive, it's murky. You don't really know. But the moment I think we start to consider motives, it becomes a lot more. It's one of those things that, as people would say, you know it when you see it, but it's hard to put a definition to. But I hate that. But that's I hear that a lot about this kind of thing. So if I were to change the example and come up and say, hey, man, I really screwed up, but I need to cover for myself here and tell these folks something so they won't sue me while I go solve the problem, versus me coming to you and saying, hey, I need to tell them this, but I need to tell them in a way so they won't panic. Everything's going to be okay. You know, we can go in and remove it and there's been no considerable damage, but I don't want to cause undue panic. Both of those are valid. Well, not valid, but both of those are realistic motives for wanting to engage in the use of doublespeak. I think people would be more inclined to encourage it if my motives were more altruistic, but be more inclined to discourage it if my motives were more selfish, for example. Wouldn't you say?
Generally, yes.
Generally, yes. Okay. So, do you think we could come up with a hard and fast rule on about it at all?
I mean, for me, so the thing that I didn't like about your original situation is not that the surgeon didn't come out and say, oops, left a razor blade in there or whatever. You know, it was the, like, intentional use of technical jargon to really tell them nothing because they have to go and look up what those words mean to tell what you just told them.
Yeah, so you're buying yourself time between telling them and hopefully being able to leave before they can look them up. Yeah, I mean,
but even then, like, I've heard some terms thrown around, and I'm not even going to be able to recall them now. But that in no way suggests what actually happened unless you're in the field. Right. And it's like, well, what have you told anybody now? Like, stop wasting my time. All you need to do is come out, like, so I think that you can be straight without giving too much information. So I would just say, there's been a delay. We're working on it. It's nothing bad.
Yeah. And that's a different thing than being more accurate, but more technically accurate.
Right.
In a way that, you know, the recipient probably wouldn't understand. Yeah. I mean, and I don't think it escapes those in the technical field either. I've seen plenty of examples of professionals, experts, coming out to the public and saying something that even that to the public makes them go, okay, I get a sense of things are going to be okay. Those who are technically inclined look at it and go, they didn't say anything. They just said a bunch of garbage. I know no more than when I started, and that makes me feel worse, you know?
So, right, because when you see somebody come out and say nothing, that means they're hiding something.
Right. Yeah.
When someone says something but really says nothing,
so like a
they're
politician.
They're probably hiding something, yes.
Yeah. No, like, politicians do that all the time. They say nothing of substance constantly.
Right, because if you say something of substance, you might upset somebody and then they won't vote for you.
Exactly. So I think there's a difference between saying nothing of substance and then saying something of substance, but changing what you're saying to obfuscate the point, you know. I would be okay. I think that's a good way to address it, is to look at, and there's no real objective way to say how accurate what someone said was, you know, like, like saying there's been an issue or there's been a complication. They mean different things, but is one more accurate than the other when describing a medical mistake? You know, I mean, I think some people would say, yes, you know, this word to me means more blah, blah, blah. But technically,
I think
speaking,
that's just highly subjective in people's experience with words. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, I don't think you can necessarily attribute malice to somebody for using a certain word just because they used it, you know? So now there's two things technically three things, because we've talked about saying nothing of substance, obfuscating the point, and then there is using technical jargon just because of the setting you're in. And then obfuscating. Now, would you say that someone using like the term racist or racism, when you're in a discussion and you're calling into question an act, and you're asserting that initially you're asserting that, hey, I think that act was racist, here are my reasons, and then someone comes in and drops the technical term, now is that the same as doublespeak, or is that a different thing?
No, that's not doublespeak, I don't think. I think it could be multiple things. At best, it is pedantry, which I'm not necessarily opposed to, as you well know. but it could very well be disingenuous in, you know, dismissal of a valid question or argument by focusing on the word used rather than the meaning thereof.
Yeah. I think that's another bit of context as well.
Because what I really mean, if I'm calling into question an action for being racist, when I ask, was that racist, I'm not necessarily saying, do you in every context associate the label racist with this act? I'm asking, do you think that one does this act with hateful intent on the basis of race?
Right.
And so avoiding the actual question to focus on the word that I chose to use and saying, oh, well, you should have said racially prejudiced or whatever. It's like, okay, fine. Is it this other thing? Like, you're just wasting my time.
Right.
And it really points to, you just don't want to answer the question because you don't like the answer.
Right. Well, and I think that's a good way to address it. I see this happen a lot. You know, people will go down a debate in one way and then get immediately pulled off topic discussing definitions.
Right. It is a debate tactic in the most dishonest sense of the term debate. A debate tactic to drag somebody down the rabbit hole of defining things to waste their time and not actually get anywhere, philosophically speaking.
Right.
This is the bad side to pedantry.
Right.
One can be maliciously pedantic.
Definitely. Absolutely can. I think it also... Now, do you think that it's of merit to call into question a bad faith interlocutor's, I said it right?
You did it.
There you go.
You fixed it.
Yeah. I didn't have my sticky, so. do you think it's appropriate sometimes to call into question their motives? Or when you are, or does it depend on the kind of debate you're in, you know?
In almost all cases, you should not do that. Because that is an ad hominem attack. So, basically, the only time you should... And so now we're just answering the question, when is it okay to perform an ad hominem attack? And the answer is, when you have concluded there is no possibility of further rational discussion with this person, and you now want to smear them in front of an audience.
Right. I totally agree with that.
But you risk burning a lot of bridges by doing that. It's a very risky thing to do.
I see you're thinking a lot about counter-arguments top. Was it he who talked about
this? Well, yes. It's actually not what I was thinking of, but yes. Oh.
You almost quoted it like word for word there for a minute. It was interesting.
I think that was from his 12 Angry Men
it was.
Thing. But no, that's actually not even what I was thinking of. But yes, lots of parallels there. But I mean, you know, if you're speaking before an audience or debating before an audience, and you know, if there's some fence sitters, some people may just not appreciate the fact that you went for the ad hominem. And so we'll come away from it not really contemplating your argument, but just thinking about how much of a jerk you are.
Right. Okay.
I'm pretty content with that rabbit hole. So back to the original topic about context. You know, we kind of already established that it matters. Now, I don't think we've done our due diligence in really talking about what context is.
Okay.
Without pulling it up, I would say colloquially, you know, the context is, I would say context is a combination of objective and subjective things. Like, I do believe there are subjective parts of context and then objective parts of context.
Yes.
Objective parts of context are things like, where was it said? Who was it said to? Who was present? You know, and what was being discussed? Like, what had been said before and after this? And, you know, all of that. Then there's the subjective part of context, which has a lot more to do with what did someone mean when they said X, Y, or Z, you know, and then what did the other person understand based on what was said? So I think we should address them independently to begin, because, and starting with objective parts of context, because those are a lot easier to define because they're objective. You know, oh, and then one other subjective part of context, and well, and then there's the part that kind of starts to blur, and I think it's real easy to watch things slip from objective to subjective this way, and it has to do with what each person is aware of during the conversation. So, to outline the discussion, let's start with the objective. So, the objective parts of context are pretty straightforward. If you are on a news show being broadcast publicly to a national audience, you were told this, you know, we have proof that you knew this was happening, you know, or at least any reasonable person, as they would say, and you're discussing the education, let's just say a broad term, you're discussing education, that's what you've been on, this, that was the chyron that was put on screen, and you were asked a question to do with education. I don't think anybody could debate that that was what was happening. You know, you could see it. If it were recorded, you could watch it in its entirety and see everything that was said during the discussion. And then there you go.
Sure.
It's very straightforward. You know, I think the problem that comes about, especially in the information age, and you see this happen a lot, and this is where we begin to slip from objective to subjective, is someone saying something and objectively in an interview, and then we point out another objective fact that, well, this person said the exact opposite in a different time, and here are all the objective standards. They were talking about education, but they were in a
school board meeting, and it just happened to be filmed. So objectively, they said contradicting statements in these two places.
And this is where it gets to the subjective part about why they did that, or, well, that person's dishonest, or, you know, they're just playing to that audience when they're there and this audience when they're there. And it's real easy to take a bunch of objective facts and then move into the subjective. Now, one of the hardest things for me is because you see them all the time. You know, someone will be clipped saying something and they'll take the clip. The first way of taking something out of context will be taking it and taking the full 10-minute long interview and snipping it down to 15 seconds for a soundbite. That, I think, is a bit disingenuous in general, right? And there's no way, I think, to do that objectively. I don't think there's any way to... I don't think there's any way, by definition, to change the content that you're showing to somebody. You can't show a subset of a greater set of content without
losing context. I think that's obvious and objective.
You know, did you agree?
Sure.
Okay. So are we good on objective context? Like, I think that's pretty straightforward. Yes. I don't want to beat that dead horse too much, but yeah. I'm just trying to do our due diligence. I know
how much you love beating dead horses, Joe.
I do. It's a pastime. And then there's the subjective parts of context. Okay. So, what would you say is there a healthy way or a line to take when it comes to inferring some subjective context on a situation?
I've sort of mentioned that already in the context of ad hominem attacks. Generally.
Well, I mean, just as an observer, like, say I show you a 15-second clip of an interview that I tell you, this is an excerpt from a 30-minute long discussion.
Right.
Boom. What do you think about that? And I ask you that question, you will have to make some inferences.
Right. I think my default assumption, if it's someone I've never seen before, so this is a completely fresh context, then my default assumptions are that the person is well-meaning and, you know, I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean, basically, inferences are fine, but wherever there are ambiguities, you should clear those ambiguities up before drawing conclusions. So, like, if the person who showed you the soundbite from the interview has seen the whole interview, then you should ask them, okay, well, were they talking about it in this sense or this sense? Or if they haven't, then you should go watch that segment yourself.
Right.
If you care.
Right. Well, this kind of harkens back to a topic we've had a while back, kind of similar to this. And that was dealing with working assumptions versus conclusions. Being that we are humans and we don't know and are incapable of being totally objective, you know, no matter what happens, and this even happens if I'm showing you a full interview, like say I'm going to show you the full 30-minute interview, you will start constructing inferences and you will start constructing working assumptions from the moment it starts playing. At the 5-minute mark, you've built assumptions that will either stand or be corrected through the remainder of the interview, right? So it's not unlike you to do that, unlike a person to do that if they're just shown a soundbite either, you know. How do you treat a working, how would you in a scenario like this, treat that working, your working, what's the word I'm looking for here? Assumptions versus your concrete conclusions. Like, at what point does an assumption collapse into a concrete solution? Or do you have control over that? Because theoretically, say you watch the full 30 minutes.
And there's still some ambiguities left over.
Well, there are always ambiguities left over.
Sure.
You could technically say, well, what does that person know about this subject? I need to know more about their credentials and training. Okay, now I know more about their credentials and training. Well, who trained them and how did... You can chain it forever and sure. Never reach a conclusion because of, you know...
Yeah.
Time.
I don't know. I think the simplest rule to go by is get out of it what you're going to get out of it and stand ready to be corrected about something.
Yeah. No, I could agree with that. I agree with that.
No.
I totally agree. I think that's the thing. But we still haven't arrived at... when you come to the conclusion, like, do you get to determine your conclusion from what is given to you? Because you're going to be influenced.
Well, I was going to say, no, not really. I mean, we talked about this before. Can you choose what you believe?
No.
Because it's that question.
Right.
You don't really... You can't really control what conclusions you're going to draw from having watched an interview. I mean, yeah, it's hard for me to pin down without specific examples, like where an assumption will turn into a conclusion necessarily. I mean, generally, well, assumptions in and of themselves usually aren't conclusions. You're using the assumptions as a basis upon which to build to a conclusion.
Right. That's what I'm saying, though, is like, at what point do you go from just having assumptions to then having a conclusion? But I understand it's the same question, but...
I mean, in that at that point, I mean, basic formal logic, you know, mm-hmm. I have so-and-so assumption A, assumption B. A and B leads to C, therefore C. I have a conclusion.
Okay. Are you responsible for the conclusions that you draw from anything?
Are you responsible for the conclusions that you draw from anything? I want to say no.
Okay. And that's fine. I'm asking the question because that kind of leads into, I think, the...
I mean, I think... It depends on the context. like in one sense, no, because you have no control over what's going to convince you of what, or how your brain is going to piece together the bits that it has into a conclusion. In the other sense, you're responsible in how you can apply the tools that you have for processing information. You know, learning critical thinking skills, like that is a step you can take toward making better conclusions about what you see in interviews and debates.
Right. But that kind of leads into the meat and potatoes of, I think, what a lot of people really get caught up in when we begin having this discussion about context. And that is, by having control over the information that's available and the format in which it's presented and the distribution of that information, you can change the likely conclusions of what is derived
yes.
from the information you provide.
Absolutely.
Now, are you, if you have control over the release of this information, like say I own the camera, I record the thing, and then I own the footage at that point, say. I own the literal bit, you know, the machine that's yes. holding the bits, okay, you know. Yes. I don't own the arrangement of those bits, but I have control over
yes.
the only
you have
copy.
Control over
so
the recording.
I
yes.
practically own it, even okay. if, you know, okay. we're going to step aside from the IP issue here.
This is running into more technical terminology too. So anyway, we'll just brush over that. Okay,
yeah.
Go on.
Say I look at that and go, I don't like that person. I'm going to make them look terrible. And, I cut it up in such a way that I believe will affect other people to make that person look terrible. And then I release and just put it out there for other people to see. Am I responsible at all for how the conclusion now, am I in any way responsible for the conclusions that other people are going to draw?
Yes.
Now, this is where I think the debate comes in. Why?
For the same reason that you are responsible for the conclusions that others might draw from slanderous statements. Because it's essentially what you're doing, is you are twisting reality in a way to make people believe something that isn't true.
Okay. What if I am telling them something that's true, though?
Then it's not slander.
Okay, but am I still responsible for it, even if it's honest and true?
Responsible for...
The information I put out. Like, it's technically right. It just
You're not
sounds
responsible
bad.
For what people do with that information.
Right, I know, I understand that. But I'm...
But I mean, yes, you're responsible for your actions.
Okay. But what can be done? Okay, is there any... I guess the problem I have is that it's not up to me how people interpret the information I put out. Now, it does...
But you stated beforehand that you specifically doctored the footage to lead people to a certain conclusion. So in that sense, it really was your doing.
Oh, yeah, it definitely was. And that's wrong.
Yes.
But I can claim ignorance to that. Like, how... I guess the problem I have is without the person just coming right out and saying, that's what I was trying to do, or writing down, this is what I'm trying to do. If I just assembled it and threw it out there, you and I both know, because we share enough, you know, common context, I guess, you know, you'll look at that and go, really, really, you're doing that to make him look bad and go, what? No, I'm not. Is there a way that you could prove that I was trying to make that person do that and hold me responsible? And if you could, like, what can you do to hold somebody responsible for, like, the problem I'm having is that there is a disconnect in, not authority, but there's a disconnect in culpability for what I do and how other people perceive it, you know? Because I can never be truly certain of how other people are going to perceive something. Now, that doesn't mean that I'm off the hook for them perceiving it a certain way, necessarily. I definitely gave them something to perceive in this way, right?
Like, I can show you a picture, and I'm responsible for showing you this picture. I'm not responsible for anything you do after showing you this picture. I just have a hard time accepting that I'm responsible for how you see this picture. You see what I'm saying? Like, I'm making it as simple as possible. I'm taking it down from, I'm just bringing it from a video to a single image I'm showing somebody, you know, without us reading too much into.
I think it goes back to your analogy with framing. You know, if you doctor a photo to make a situation look one way that is not actually representative of the situation, you are, in that sense, responsible for how I view it and react to it.
Okay, let's move to the... I want to change the circumstance to one of the, to probably the most best faith way I could do it.
Okay.
Okay. I go to a rally for a politician, and I just take a picture. Now, I'm just doing it. No one knows this but me, but my intention at that moment, I just want to capture this so that I can remember that I was here. This is for my posterity. Boom. Picture taken.
Uh-huh.
And then I post it because the internet saves everything forever and it'll always be available to me. But I pay the price for it being public. That's why it's available. Now, that image circulates. People, based on their own preconceived notions of that individual, where that person is, everything they can observe from that image, plus their experience and opinions,
mm-hmm.
is going to reach different conclusions.
Correct.
Now, I've provided a piece of their justifications for the conclusions that they've arrived at.
Yep.
And I'm responsible for that. I'm fine with that.
Okay.
But I don't think there's any meaningful way to interfere with me in any way just for that being partially responsible.
No, absolutely not.
I guess that's what I'm trying to get at. Now, that's the best faith way of presenting.
Well, right. Well, but in that sense, you're only reporting facts. Like the fact, and to be very strict about which fact you're reporting is, this rally looked like this at a moment in time. Or this rally happened, maybe. You might be saying that.
Sure. All right. I mean, and I may not be trying to say anything.
Right. But you're just providing
information
as factual as it could be. You know, from this vantage point, here's how it was. Like, sure. You cannot be held at fault for that at all.
Okay.
It's at the point where you start manipulating the raw footage and facts to paint a picture. That's when it starts slipping into you're now responsible for how people make their conclusions based on it. Because now you're trying to tailor it to lead people to a certain conclusion instead of just telling them how it is.
That's true, but I technically already did that, though. Like, in the context of reality, I took it and narrowed it by taking a single image. And I mean, like, if manipulation can be... Because I would say that manipulation is any time you change the context. Whether it, usually, almost always in reducing it. Like, I can't add to reality necessarily. You know, I can't impose more that was there. Sure. I can only ever take exactly what was or reduce it.
Yeah.
Like, for example, an image takes a 3D representation of space and time and then flattens it into a 2D image from a perspective. Particular
field of view, like...
Exactly, at a moment
in time. By physics, you can't see everything, yeah. Right. Sure.
I'm collapsing that reality into my perspective, into a moment, and that's the image. A video is kind of doing the same thing, but over time, you know, if 3D camera technologies get any better, it's like I'm relegating a space in a moment, you know, for moments of time. But I've reduced the context. I've technically manipulated and removed facts of what was going on. Like, for example, there were people that were standing behind me. How many were there? You can't tell.
Can't tell.
I've removed that information.
In the middle of the crowd or at the back.
Exactly. You don't know. So by presenting that, I'm presenting to you an already altered piece of a real situation that occurred.
Right. So the question is, did you get that particular vantage point in order to make it look a certain way? Now, you stated at the beginning that your intention was to save it for your posterity.
Yes.
Which means no, and therefore you were neutral.
Right. And it's easy when I tell you what my intentions were. The problem is, as so often these things go, you don't know what my intentions are when I show you something.
Sure.
You have to infer my intentions just like you have to infer the intentions of what's going on within the context. Mm-hmm. It's the only way you add to potential context is that, well, now I'm adding my motives to this if they exist, you know. And I guess that's my problem, is that that's the hardest thing to nail down.
Sure.
Is, well, what were your motives? You know, I don't know that. I think the only person who could ever honestly say what another person's motives were,
sure,
was the individual.
The question was, are you responsible? Not, can we prove that you meant to do that?
Right.
Like, those are not necessarily one and the same.
That's true. They are not mutually exclusive terms by any means. And so, I don't know. It's a hard thing, I think, to deal with, especially now that context can be anything. Really, it's so easy to manipulate context. It always has been pretty easy in writing, but, you know, technology's enabled us to change context, to narrow contexts off of reality. You know, you would think we have more ability to provide more context than ever before. You know, like, we have the ability to capture 3D video, like 3D 360 degree video. So something, you get your frame is everything but that point, you know. It's way more information than I could have provided with a, you know, whatever my FOV was on my single lens camera looking one way, you know. But because there's just so much information, this is all anecdotal, by the way, but now that there's so much information, you know, you could see the same event happen from many different perspectives, you know. And that's, I guess, do you think it's a problem that we can be provided more with more context than we could have ever achieved on our own? Like, to give an example, if I were to be there, right, if I was there at the rally, say, and I'm standing there and I'm watching things that are happening, I have a more limited context than
If you were sitting at home looking at all the different streams of it.
Exactly. Do you think that, and I would assume that we're not necessarily suited for that as well.
No.
It seems fairly obvious, but I mean, we typically, you know, in nature, we don't observe the same phenomena from multiple perspectives, for example.
No.
Right.
Not usually.
Not usually.
In fact, not ever. No. But
right. So I think more care obviously needs to be taken when we do that. I just think
I don't know. I don't see any harm in it, really.
I don't think that it's harmful. I just think that it's, you can't treat a situation. You cannot behave as though you did, if though you were in a vacuum. That's what I'm trying to say. Before, like, say, you know, you're by yourself witnessing an event. There was no, you don't consider, well, what would it have looked like from over there? You don't typically have to consider that because it doesn't matter to you, right? Like, I don't think it's something that occurs to people to say, that would have looked kind of bad from that angle. Like, that's something that when, if you're watching something happen, you're like, oh, okay,
this is happening.
This is happening, yeah. I don't need to think about how it would look for some other angle. But now that I know that it's, and even when we were in a group from, you know, even when we're in a group, typically we still don't necessarily consider, well, how does that look to that person over there? You know, we're agents. We're selfish. I don't care how you see it because I was there. This is what I saw, and it's the facts, and it's real. And there's no way back then that you could have you couldn't have communicated to me with the same accuracy what you perceived that you can now, you know. And I think that's what's adding to a lot of the stress that deals with these kind of conversations. Because no one, you know, everyone has something to say about framing. Everyone has something to say about context now. Is, well, I don't care that they saw it that way. You know, they're being bad faith. Or, oh, did you see what so-and-so did? It's like, yeah, well, that was a bad angle. You know, we're all way too consciously aware, I think, and not necessarily a bad thing, but we're way more consciously aware of how things appear to other people. Like, we're a lot more just aware of it, you know, as a consequence of what we're capable of witnessing now. And I think it's a good thing. Because I rarely say more information is a bad thing, if ever, you know. But as far as how we process that information, and then on top of all of that, that's all of these things that are going on.
I think that there is a time, actually, when more information is bad.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's not necessarily that the presence... Rather, it's not that the existence of the information is bad. Exposure to too much information is a thing. For instance, and I will try to remove the context that's coming to mind. But one can be inundated with news about a particular subject that is not necessarily helpful on dealing with the subject at hand, but merely creates more stress.
I mean, I understand. I understand,
you
know, what
something bad is happening. Oh, and this is also bad about it, and this too, and this too, and this too. It's like, okay, it's bad. What am I learning now besides just
how bad?
Yep, it right. It's just yep, it's bad, and I'm stressed about it now.
I think that could be its own episode. And you know what? I think next week.
How many times have we said next week and then not done it?
Well, I'll write it down this time.
This time.
So okay. We'll make sure to do it. Too much context next week.
Too much context. Okay.
But yeah, just to quickly recap on this, you know, context matters. I would say, by and large, subjective. there are objective parts of context, but it's important not to try to combine the two. And it's a difficult subject to talk about. I think it's always worthy of consideration. You know, it's unavoidable. Especially since everything has context. The thing that you're discussing has a context, but also you discussing it has its own context. And so it's always valuable to kind of have those meta discussions about why you're discussing what you're discussing and why you think the things that you think and all those other pieces of context. But I also think it's important, as this episode may have shown, that it's not always worth it to just focus on the context, because the thing that you really, you know, it's important never to lose sight of
what you're talking about and what's being considered in light of the context. So anything else to add?
Nope.
All right. Philosophers.
Philosophers.